And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Believe it or not, this is episode 22
in the series.
They said it wouldn't last.
I'm feeling 22. It's a T-Swizzle reference.
All I got is just 22 and I don't mind dying.
Exactly. Well, okay.
Little Who Do You Love? You guys know that song, right?
Absolutely.
Sure. Am I the only one?
No, yeah,
no,
you
I know,
know
it.
Okay.
Isn't Hootie making a comeback in the country western
like
world?
It, but I know.
What's
it.
That?
Hootie from Hootie.
He's redefining the genre.
Yeah.
That's a comeback.
Oh, he's not making a comeback. He's been a huge country star for the last
several
years.
Since about 07, 08, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's been busy raising imaginary
been busy.
Children.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
But yes, welcome to Chatter on Books. Hello, Tori. Hello, David, Jeannie, Michael.
Hello.
How's everybody doing tonight?
Okay.
Good. Allergies killing me.
Yeah, it's that wonderful. It's great spring weather.
Beautiful day.
Except for every time you
can't
go out
spend
your car.
Any time
yeah, you go out your car in D.C. in the springtime and it's yellow.
It's coated.
Completely.
It's
coated
like
with
green
pollen.
Talcum powder.
Yeah. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. Our nation's capital.
Yeah.
But we have a fun show for you tonight.
We do. We're coming to you from Chatter, live, corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Streets, Northwest, home of Chatter, the restaurant where it's a great place to watch the Caps.
Caps.
This show will be ending right on time tonight because we got a puck drop at 7 p.m.
I got a lot to talk about tonight. I might go long.
There you go.
Enjoy. You enjoy.
You're on your own, big guy.
Yeah. So we have some great stuff on tap tonight. We have Chuck Culpepper with us, who many people know as the guy who covers everything under the sun on sports for the Washington Post. He is a nomad. I think he's a 21st century Renaissance man.
All that.
And he's written a wonderful book called Bloody Confusion, which is an American sports writer finding solace in English soccer. And it's wonderful. And I'm going to take him back into some wonderful adventures he had when he was there, including the Pompey Blue Bear, Chuck. So get ready for that. Pompey Blue Bear, who I think was your best friend the entire time you
it's
were
everybody's
there.
Everybody's best friend.
Exactly.
I wish Nigel was here because he's a hooligan. He's a well-known guy.
That's right.
He is.
So they would.
Yeah.
I think he's in jail.
I think he's standing in front of a barrister right now.
Doing a little time.
Pretty sure.
But we got a few things to knock out. We have a book report. Survey results are in.
Okay.
Right? Survey results are in. We're going to have a little crossfire. Does the Great American Novel exist anymore? Can anyone write it? Yes or no? The people driving by honking their horns say yes.
I think that's a let's go Caps honk.
And to honor Shakespeare, supposedly tomorrow would be his birthday. April 23rd would be his birthday. His 455th, to be exact. So instead
he's a little older than me and Tony.
Just a teensy bit.
Yeah.
But if you added you together and multiplied times dog years. Have you ever seen that sign? I think I might have seen this outside a bar in England, as a matter of fact. And it was one of those easel boards, and it says, in dog years, I've only had 3 beers.
That's good.
That's pretty good.
That's good.
It's in front of my house now. But we're going to talk about your favorite Shakespeare.
Yes.
Which I debate whether or not Shakespeare ever actually was a single person, but we're going to talk about that. A little housekeeping. Battle of the Books is on. We're getting some very interesting applicants for Battle of the Books. And hopefully the first competition will be the first Monday in June. If you go to chatteronbooks.com, you two can register. You will come in. You have to be a finished author, right, Jeannie, but not yet published.
Right.
And you're going to pitch us on your
book.
Do
your elevator pitch, right?
Do your elevator pitch, and we'll ask you some obnoxious questions, and there will be a winner, and you get fabulous prizes. And if you're really good, we'll let you come back in a few months and compete in the finals, which is $1,000.
So, that's so awesome.
Yeah. And we should thank Claire for the Facebook page, right?
Claire does a great job on the Facebook page. It is Chatter on Books, the fan community. They are great. They keep everybody up to date on what books we have recommended, which other people are pestering me to keep track of, and I don't. So thank you, Claire.
And this is Claire. At Cool Aunt Claire on Twitter as well.
That's right. Yes. Doing a great job.
Yes.
Independent Bookstore Day is this Saturday. Go to your independent bookstore this Saturday. Earlier today, I went up to East City Bookshop up on Capitol Hill, Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast, where I used to spend a lot of time, 645 Pennsylvania Avenue. Two terrific people, Lori and Emily. One knows more about books than the next one, and they were wonderful. So if you have to pick one bookstore, go there this weekend, and you'll have a great time. Calvert Woodley.
Yes.
What do we got this week?
You.
Michael and the gang, happy birthday to Ed Sands, celebrating his 80th birthday
happy
in the Turks
birthday,
and Caicos Ed. This weekend.
Yeah.
Awesome. I'm not sure I'm supposed to share that with everyone,
well,
but I have.
You just did.
I just did. And the Sands family is there celebrating his 80th. But in the meantime, Jen took care of us, and we have this evening Jeannie and I have already partaken. The wine is a white Bordeaux from Chateau Thule, a vineyard which is the showcase estate, and evidently right when everybody else in Europe was giving up on white wine and ripping out all their white grapes and throwing in red grapes, mm-hmm. New Zealand and Australia start to make a run at the white wine in Bordeaux. So this particular estate, the Chateau Thule, decided, nope, we're going to stick with this. And they've created this white Bordeaux. Jeannie, what do you think?
I like this wine a little too much.
Yeah.
It is very nice. It's a Sauvignon Blanc, but with it doesn't have any strong acidity or lemony notes to sound like a real connoisseur.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I like
tennis
it.
Balls.
I like it very much.
Good. Yeah, they Jen says full-bodied, exotic fruit flavors. Mm-hmm. Would go with fish, poultry, and some light meals. Mm-hmm. But it's lovely. David, you had a little.
It was very good. Yes, good. Very, very
okay.
good.
And then Calvert Woodley also gave us a cheese.
Cheese is outstanding.
I think this might be our best cheese yet.
Very good cheese.
So too.
In honor of our featured author who spent a lot of time in England, it is a Wensleydale cheese from Yorkshire, England. And it's made from cow's and sheep's milk, originally made by some monks starting in about 1140 or something like that. And they got wiped out for some reason, 1560. Nigel could probably tell us why. And they turned over this cheese making to some farmers' wives. It's always the Vikings.
Vikings or Putin, one or the other.
It's both.
But these farmers' wives have been making ever since. And it's really, really good.
It's good.
Jeannie, again, we were saying it's.
It's creamy. You look at it, it looks like it's very creamy, but it has a sharpness to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
A little salty.
Very Winston good. Yeah. From Yorkshire, England. So we love that. Chuck, did you ever go to Yorkshire, England?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay,
sure
there we go. Chuck okay, says. Eat some cheese. We'll be back
have
to you soon.
Have some cheese, drink some red. It's
but
a day.
First,
uh-oh.
Book report, update. Survey results. So just to remind people, David, yes. 6 weeks ago, gave me the option of doing for my book report either Boys on the Bus.
Any of.
Invisible Man or Unbroken, all any excellent choices.
Three.
And it was too hard for me to decide, so we outsourced the decision. We did a survey on Twitter, and it was interesting how it did change, and different people would weigh in. Mm-hmm. Robert Berg, right? He came in big on Invisible Man, and
that,
I think...
That makes sense.
Yep.
Knowing
I think
Robert.
That helped a lot. So, Unbroken got 29%. Mm-hmm. Boys on the Bus got 32%. And our winner with 39% is Invisible Man.
There you go.
Yes.
Winner.
So I'm on it.
One of
these decades.
Take your time.
One of these decades.
The show's going to be on for years and years and years.
Exactly.
That is a 4 to 6 week read for you.
I think I looked, and I think it's about as long as the Mueller report. I think it's 468 pages, to be exact. Yeah. Yeah.
It's not a bad read.
It's a good read.
No, it's
read.
A great read.
It's an important
All three
read.
Of them are great reads. Yeah. I've had the stack on my table for a while, and I keep looking and going, oh, I love that one. I
for
love
extra
that
credit,
one.
You could do two books.
Okay. Might be a haiku. My report might be a haiku, I'm thinking. Okay. From the ridiculous to the sublime, and I don't know what got me going down this path, but the great American novel. And given the world in which we operate now and how fast everything moves, is there such a thing anymore? Can anybody be writing it? And before I open this up, do you guys even know where the expression came from, Great American Novel?
No.
I do not. Michael?
I've Googled this, so.
I'm guessing it's a white male.
It's not
Good
a,
guess.
Yeah, it's not a fair
Go ahead,
question.
Michael.
No, no, I'll let you read this.
No,
I just
no,
Wikipedia'd
go.
It. No. What I found, and I will be quoting from the most reliable source, the term Great American Novel.
Is that Wikipedia?
Novel, comes directly from the title of an 1868 essay by American Civil War novelist John William DeForest. He defined the Great American Novel as, quote, the picture of the ordinary emotions and manners of American existence. Now, as you're listening to that definition, grab your highlighter, your pen. I want you to be underlining certain terms. Tori, what did you underline for us?
I just highlighted that line from his essay. Which, interestingly, was written in 1868 in The Nation. And he says that, and it's almost, you think, well, now with looking back, oh, of course that's what the great American novel is. But you go on to read the whole essay, and one of the things he says is it's impossible to do that because everything is just, my words, not his, everything's just a snapshot. I think he used the word cameo. People, and he goes through a lot of authors at the time, just no, it's just a cameo. It's just a brief glimpse. So he was saying back then, Michael, tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I think he was saying back then it was impossible to write something that he described should be the great American novel because things are moving too fast. And that was in 1868.
Wow.
So think about how fast things move now.
And one of the issues you have when you're looking at a question like this is just the relative youth of our country and the inclusion of great at the beginning of that. Mm-hmm. Yes. So as you are looking at, say, if you were to Google just great American novels and the types of books you're seeing, those are really hard to, say, throw against contemporary American fiction that you might be reading, particularly as the taste, the expectations, and our awareness as to what we are including. Because I think as we're looking at this currently, the idea of inclusion and equity is something that you can't ignore.
When I started looking at this, I thought we had a conversation some weeks ago about the classics. Mm-hmm. And they were classics, and they were classics for a reason, but they were always written from the perspective of an old white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so did it really
the
represent?
Canon.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And some of those conversations come into play when you look at these things as well. But if you accept those as the great American novel, and I don't know now if I do, is there a great American novel now, or can the great American novel be written? Jeannie?
I don't think it can be. I think fiction is now the way TV is, the way music is. Mm-hmm. When we grew up, there were three networks.
Right. Yep.
When we grew up, there was no internet. When we grew up, there were like three or four big recording companies that controlled everything. And now it is so dispersed. It is so diverse, to me, for the better, that you can't plant a flag in a Philip Roth or an F. Scott Fitzgerald now the way maybe somebody would have tried to have done it decades ago. That there's just too much going on, and much of it is very interesting and wonderful, as it is in TV, as it is in cinema, as it is in music.
Does anything you've read, Jeannie, in the last 5-10 years come close?
No. I mean, I've read some really wonderful books. I've read a lot of mediocre books.
Right.
I mean, sometimes I think perhaps this diversity might weaken the process, that there aren't these sort of, you know, highbrow literary agents and editors who are really honing this process. And that might be a downside, but I'd still rather the openness, the, you know, let's throw something up against the wall and on Amazon and self-publish and see if somebody buys
it. Right. You'd rather get 100 individual snapshots and maybe that creates the landscape.
There isn't a Gottlieb, you know, Uber editor like sort of controlling things for standards.
Right.
As
deciding
as
what
was.
We should think.
Yes.
David?
Yeah,
well, it would require a redefinition, wouldn't it? I mean, point of view is everything, and certainly so many novels, books, whatever, are written from a totally different point of view than what would have been accepted as the quote-unquote American point of view, right? I mean, so I don't know how you could possibly agree to what we would consider American, you know, these days. I mean, is Alice Walker American? Sure. But not to everyone, you know.
Right.
So that would be, it would be completely different than, you know, someone else's standards of what an American novelist would be. So we are going through that as a country. What does it mean to be American? We are literally going through that right now as a country, you know. So we're arguing about what the definition should be and who should be doing the defining. So I think it's almost impossible to reach a consensus on what an American novel would be. Now, having said that, I think there's lots of novels. There's lots of there are a lot of writers who could certainly be viewed as quintessentially American. If you were looking at America from the perspective of an immigrant, if you were looking at America from the perspective of a person of color or a woman, you could, all of those are American, but who's decided?
Who's captured them all?
Right.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
You read his quote, and it's pretty amazing. I need to go back and read more about how this particular essay became that's the definition of the great American novel, which everybody capitalizes now, by the way.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But the picture of the ordinary emotions and manners of American existence. Well, whose emotions?
Right.
Whose existence?
Exactly.
Michael?
So at first, I was struggling with the idea of great in front of that, and now I'm just struggling with novel, because I do think as we look at something that's novel, it is hard to see something that is new in this space. And so much of this is, as we come back to privilege, I'm thinking of the privileged author who has gone through X amount of classes at their master's writer's workshop and is part of that brotherhood, and they are pumping out these half-finished ideas that make sense in the reading room, that are checking the box of what their peers want to read, but they're missing out on this authenticity. And I think until we get back to that authenticity, we're going to be in this stall pattern. If we think about a lot of the writers, my generation, a little bit older, it's easy for me to say this, but you're coming from that position of privilege of just a country that was fat on its own success. As you look at where we were in the latter half of the century, when we've had sort of a dearth of some of these authors and books, these larger than life forces. And, you know, a seed that grows from some of the pain, some of the suffering that we've been through in these recent years could lead to those new voices. Because I do think for that novel story to come back, it is going to be the story of the immigrant. It is going to be a story of representation, and it is going to require a shift in the decision makers to recognize maybe this is when I step down because the novel has changed and I don't have the vision to recognize that when it comes into place.
Would it change our opinion about this if it was not the Great American Novel, but it was the Great American Book? The reason I say that is when I was thinking about this and reading and looking up and things like that, I kept coming back to things like Tara Westover, who wrote Educated. I'm not really sure she went through everything she said she went through, but it's in nonfiction. But it was an example of how people are going through the changes in this country. Right? I'm sure I could find other examples. And I just wonder if novel doesn't constrict somehow the debate over, is this really a representation of the emotions and the feelings and what's going on in this country at this time?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because certainly there was a lot of debate about Hillbilly Elegy, for example, you know, and whether that was an accurate representation of, you know, Appalachian. And I know a lot of people in West Virginia who went, okay, that was not what, you know, but you know, okay, maybe it fit some people's definition, or some, it was right for some people, but it wasn't right for everybody. So you continue to have that kind of debate about what's real, what's authentic, and what's not.
Okay, because I've said this 1,000 times, so I'm going to say it 1,001 times. Scott Price, S.L. Price, who we had on maybe the second show, who wrote that great book, Playing Through the Whistle, which I think did what Hillbilly Elegy wish it had done. And that was, Playing Through the Whistle was such a great example of what this country is going through. I thought, that's an important book.
Sure.
Sitting here thinking, I'm a fiction person. I was an English major, but I would say some of the most fascinating books I've read in the last 5-10 years have been nonfiction. Have been Isabel Wilkerson's, is it The Warmth of 1,000 Suns, about the migration from the South to northern cities. I'm blanking on her name now, but the New York Times reporter who wrote about the hospital in Louisiana during Katrina went, you know.
She whose name we do not remember. Claire will figure it out.
Selena. I'm sorry, I'm blanking. I'm blanking on that and the title. But it's a gripping, excellent book. And very, very American.
Yes.
As Isabel Wilkerson's was as well. Very American. Yeah. And not about the pleasant, sunny side of America at all.
Yeah.
Does it have to be tragic? Does the Great American Novel have to be tragic, Mark?
I don't think you can define it like that. I mean, I think each attempt to write the Great American Novel, I mean, it depends on what they're writing about. You know, I don't think it necessarily has to be tragic. Why would you think that?
I looked at the list of what Google decides are the Great American Novels. Google, they're all sad. They're all.
Yeah, but look at the timestamps as to when those novels were being written, and the purpose of writing behind the guise of a novel, say a piece of nonfiction, just an essay, there is safety in discussing difficult conditions through metaphor. And if you think about why we might be able to move away from the label of novel, when we think about the speed at which we discover information, the paths that we have to open up our creativity, the power that is given to the previously voiceless, all of a sudden you don't necessarily need to hide behind that nom de plume or the idea of a novel. You can name names. There's power in that now. And there are ways to get your info out. And even beyond changing it from, say, novel to book, there's no reason why you can't change forms, say, within that story that's going to capture the ordinary American experience. Why can't it include hybrid media models that include music, that include poetry, that include pictures? If we think about how powerful,
like a graphic novel,
I feel bad because I don't remember his name. We got a fascinating email from somebody Washington, D.C. area, who is creating this incredible, essentially multimedia book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's not crazy. It's one of these things where you will be able to immerse yourself into it in a multimedia experience and create different endings and go down different paths. And it's just and he's saying, he wants to be on Battle of the Books. And he says, I just want to pitch this because it's a very, very different thing. It's not reading in the conventional sense, but it is reading. So
can I just give credit to Sherry Fink, who
there
wrote
you go.
5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm Ravaged Hospital.
Right.
It's a 2013 nonfiction book about what happened to this particular hospital when Katrina hit.
So I would like to suggest we now launch the Great American Book.
Okay.
We should take a break here because the puck drops in 36 minutes.
And more importantly, we have a great author.
We have a great author. Yes. We have Chuck Culpepper, who has written a fabulous book. So we will be back in a second. We are back, and we are back with Chuck Culpepper, who many, many, many people know as this guy who works at the Washington Post, who covers all things sports. You're a nomad. You're an absolute nomad. You've lived all over the world, and you continue to move all over the world. But let's start at the beginning. Normally, I would say, what did you want to be when you were five? But I'm fascinated by your last name, and I've spent more time in Culpepper, Virginia than anybody needs to know. And you're from Suffolk, Virginia.
Yes.
Where did the name come from? Do you know?
I think Virginia in its early going. I think the second governor of Virginia had the name Culpepper.
Do you know the origins of the name Culpepper?
I don't have any. Oh, England. If you go to Covent Garden in London and you go to that mall thingy.
Uh-huh.
It's prettier thingy than a mall.
Yeah.
But you'll see a Culpepper store there.
So, Suffolk, Virginia, you worked for the local newspaper when you were very young. Did you cover sports?
Not really.
Were you a jock?
No.
Wow. Okay. Great career move. Really good career move.
I wanted to be a sports writer when I was 8.
Why?
I saw the datelines in the newspaper. They were running around.
Somewhere else.
These guys were running around.
Oh, what watching a great
games.
Observation.
They were mobile and they were watching games.
You never wanted to be the shortstop for the Yankees. You wanted to be these guys that got,
that would be terrible.
Uh-huh. So did you have good
Nobody cares who I date.
Did you have good teachers? Do you remember a librarian? Mm-hmm. We love to do, did you have a public library that you went to?
No, but one in the school.
Uh-huh.
And
your librarian helped you?
She did.
How?
Her name was Marie Bowman. I still
know. Excellent. You think she's still alive today?
Yes.
I'll send her a note.
I know it, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
No, sometimes I do send my teachers a note. I had a teacher in fifth grade named Doreen Huling, H-U-L-I-N-G.
How about that?
She lives around Charlotte. We started emailing a few years ago.
Everyone should do that. Public service announcement.
Yeah.
Everyone should occasionally send an email, send something out to some teacher you have that you like, because they never get them, and they're always getting dragged into the principal's office to deal with some obnoxious kid and their family, and they get those emails, and it makes everything to them.
She was remarkable.
In what way?
First day we got to school, there were five blackboards of handwritten notes. She loved history the best. And maybe 25 minutes into her first lecture about history, she said, "Am I boring you?" And I thought, far from it. And I was 11 or 10 or whatever you are in fifth, 10, right?
10, 10 or 11. Yeah.
But even for a teacher to ask that question is incredibly enlightened. Mm-hmm.
In fact, I just went to the ACC tournament in Charlotte a few weeks ago, and it
the
dawned
Rescue
on me
Final
that,
Four.
I had not, that I had not called her. I need to call her.
Yeah.
So, there you go, after the show.
Exactly.
And tell her to listen.
Actually, I was living in Abu Dhabi.
Uh-huh.
And I
applied for
a bank account.
Yeah.
And they asked for the security questions. And one was, what was the name of your best teacher?
How about that?
So I put in Doreen Huling. And at that moment, I decided to email her to find her. And, in the public school system in Charlotte, I think she was. So I found her and we exchanged a bunch of emails.
Oh, good for you. So speaking of Abu Dhabi, you become a sports writer. You're all over the place. You're covering everything. And at a certain point, jumping into your book, you got bored or you got fed up or you got cynical. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I've read the book. Mm-hmm. I've listened to the book. And you said, I need a break, right? Inspiration for your book.
Well, I also said I could have continued on that path pretty happily. Mm-hmm. To the end, you know? But, I mean, when you go to your 11th Super Bowl and you're kind of You know, media day is so...
It's awful.
What is it?
It's soul-sucking.
Dehumanizing.
It's soul-sucking.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah, it's awful.
Why is it... Why is it soul-sucking?
Because the same questions, the same
controlled.
Answers.
It's controlled. It's so controlled.
It's right. 400 people all trying to ask the most ridiculous questions possible to get an interesting response from somebody.
Is it inhuman or subhuman? Or...
Sub. I think so.
Yeah. Inhuman can be interesting.
It's gotten even worse now because media credentials are awarded to
anybody.
Yeah. A clown. A clown in a Volkswagen can come in and ask questions.
What would be the word for I actually don't want to be human anymore? That's what it is.
You know,
right?
You can't do a trait.
A human.
You can't do a story like you want to do, like you normally would do, which is you'd spend time with somebody, you'd ask them questions, and you'd ask their friends questions, and then you'd write a nice story about them, however the reporting leads you, right? You can't do that at the Super Bowl because as soon as you ask somebody something, the next person is screaming at them, you know, what was your favorite character on Happy Days?
What's your sign?
Can you sing something now?
Yeah.
Is a hot dog a sandwich?
Right.
Exactly.
Boxers or briefs.
Right.
Okay, what did your friends, what did your family, what did your bosses say when you said, I'm going to go live in England for a while and learn everything I can about English soccer?
Well, again, it was so, I probably wouldn't have had the guts to just say I'm bored with this and move to England, but then something happened. Mm-hmm. Which was I was one of those I don't know if you ever heard this, love exiles.
Yeah.
So I was living with and later married to a Colombian guy, and at the time,
good
and
soccer
still,
player,
still married. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But at that time in the U.S., you either had to break up or find yourself another country.
Right.
So that's, we found ourselves another country. So that was the. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, you know, it was horrifying. It made me angry, of course.
Yes.
It was terrifying. It was
unfair.
It was unfair, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, but if something like that, I have something to say. But sometimes the worst thing that ever happened to you is turns out to be the best. I hate to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because it really set me kind of on a path of seeing the world a lot more than I ever have.
Yeah, and something I was sort of thought I would ask you about at the end, but I'll ask you at the beginning. Have you ever read Bill Buford's book, Among the Thugs?
Mm-hmm.
So this one of my favorite guys, New Yorker guy, he wrote Heat, which is a great book.
I love Heat. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think in 1980 is when Among the Thugs came out, and he decided to go do a book about the hooligans who were famous.
Yeah.
English soccer for anybody outside of England. Gosh, I wish Nigel were here. it was all about these hooligans and the violence and the incredible violence around those games. And Buford goes over to figure this out, and he essentially embeds himself. And one of the most remarkable things is it goes on, he went there to learn about them and why do they do this. He becomes them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he goes over there and finds a very dark, bad place in him, putting words in his mouth. But he finds a very dark place in himself being among the thugs. You go over there, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you found your joy again about sports.
That's
right.
And by the time I got there, the thug problem had been solved.
Completely. Mm-hmm.
And had been solved in a way that big problems like that seldom get solved.
Yeah.
With video cameras in the stadiums. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to get in a fight, you had to go across town. You had to schedule the fight for somewhere across town from the stadium. We're going to have a fight at such and such.
But talk a little bit about the stadiums. God bless Brian, who's out here. Brian and I went over last August specifically to go see some games. And we went Liverpool, Man U, West Ham, three or four games.
Wow.
And we kind of knew that things had been cleaned up some, but we were also a little bit hopeful, right? We're Caps fans, for God's sake. And first of all, the away fans are very carefully contained. And you buy a beer, you don't take it into the stadium with you.
Mm-hmm.
You drink it out there. And the police presence at even the simplest of games is pretty heavy duty, right?
And the idea that the police line up on both sides of the away fans.
It's a cordon around the away fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So whenever isn't it the strangest thing maybe I can think of that we're a more violent society than they are, I would say, on balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in stadiums, we sit together, you know.
Right. For the most part,
except
without
in Philadelphia.
All that many fights.
Yes, except for Philadelphia.
I remember once I went to the upper deck at Yankee Stadium on a Red Sox day, and, you know, they taunt each other.
Right.
some guy stood up in a Red Sox cap and said, "Yankees haven't won a World Series since 1947 without a left-handed starter." I was like, wow. That's so brutal.
Cut me like a knife.
Wow. So mean. But, you know, but then there's in other places in Europe, it's still common to see fights, but yeah. We don't. It's not common.
That's
for
true.
Us. We sit among right. each well, other.
It's much. It's
really strange.
In college football, for sure.
Oh, with, that's a with big one. Yeah.
Blood feuds. They don't have a lot of fighting.
I guess I'm going to very different games than you all, but I have seen many fights break out. There was a near one in Raleigh the other night that I won't go into any details.
Yeah, but you almost picked on an AARP veteran.
Yeah.
Well, and where was it? Was it the Jets or the Giants where they threw ice balls at Santa?
Yeah.
Oh,
somebody throws batteries on the ice.
Yeah, I mean that does happen, but it is an outlier now. It's not the norm. It's not every week.
Yeah, English soccer games now, which surprises everybody from here who goes over there, they are so quiet, they are so calm.
It's except for Monday night, and that's because they've been drinking all day, and that's what. I mean, I would never sit in a crowd on a Monday night game anywhere because they've been drinking for 7 hours.
Yeah. No, and I don't know if this is still going on, but when I was there, there was thug nostalgia.
Yes.
People who longed for the days when you could just go have a good fight.
This happened to me walking into an Eagles game about 5 years ago on a Monday night. They said, "Remember the good old days when we used to pound Redskins fans into the urinals?"
They don't use urinals there. They urinate out in the open. Philadelphia.
Flow free Fridays.
Under-publicized poundings of Redskins.
Okay, there are so many things. There are so many wonderful stories in this book. And as I say all the time, I've read the book. I've listened to the book. Two things: Pompey the Blue Bear, your best friend. It seems like he became a soulmate.
He lives in Sydney.
Tell us about who Pompey the Blue Bear is.
Okay, so I was riding on a bus to like a.
Because the train service was out.
Because the trains don't work.
So you had to ride a bus.
They get you on a bus, a replacement bus, they call it. And the windows were foggy because the weather's always, it's drizzly or whatever. And I saw the blue bear. I had seen the blue bear before, but suddenly I saw him on the bus across the way using his paw to clear the window. And I was like, I have to meet him.
And you did.
I did.
Go on.
He's such a wonderful man. And, he used to wave to children passing by in his blue bear costume. And I don't know why he decided to be Pompey Bear, but he just...
And he asked people to hold his wallet because a bear has no pockets.
Right. And he moved to Sydney, which is a
girlfriend,
tough...
right?
Yes. And it's a tough place for bears to live,
Especially a blue one.
So, there's no, your fur just falls off.
It's basically really hot.
Humidity. Yeah. And if you listen to the audio version of your book, which I highly recommend, one gets to hear you sing. It's very brave of you. It's very brave of you. And I'm hoping you're not giving up the day job for a singing career, with all due respect.
Is that right? Is that in there?
Yeah. Oh, you've forgotten?
I would never listen to that.
You talk often in the book about the different cheers and the chants, which the English fans often set to American tunes, which is a little weird.
But I cannot get over that.
You sang a lot of them.
John Philip Sousa? I couldn't believe that.
I was at Liverpool last year when they sang, who is it? It's the Johnny Cash song.
Walk the Line?
No.
Ring of Fire?
Yes, exactly. And they changed the words.
Is that right? Our anthem is set to a British drinking song. So.
Yeah.
Is it Ring of Fire? Anachronon in Heaven.
They sang one to Elvis Presley. A lot seemed to be... set to One Ton Amara, which is not American.
Right.
Yeah, it's not English either.
Is this the way to Amarillo? Is that Neil Sedaka? Is that right?
I'm not familiar with that tune.
They sing that in train stations. I don't know if they still do.
Do you know the way to San Jose? Is that what you... No, that's something else anyway.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of the Pompey tunes? So talk about how you adopted Portsmouth as your team.
Well, I went down... You know how Americans are if we love those grotesque old stadiums like Fenway and Wrigley.
Where
it's just gross, but we love it.
Yeah.
We also love our spiffy new places.
Yes.
So we love those.
Yes.
With fancy
we're
food.
No in between with us. It's either old or new.
Right?
True.
But I went down to I had a relegation weekend where
you might have to explain relegation.
I love relegation.
I do too.
They should be
adopted
into American
in
sports.
Every league in America.
Wish we had.
Yes, I agree.
ahead.
Would any of the treasured teams around here have been relegated at some
point? Oh, no, yes.
Wizards.
I guess the Reds.
Million years
Redskins.
Ago.
Redskins.
Soon, you know.
Long time. Yeah.
Who knows?
But can you just give us 30 seconds on what relegation
sure,
is relegation, for the uninitiated?
Which happens all around the world is the demotion of, and deeply emotional.
Of losers.
Demotion of the bottom some number of teams. It's three in the English Premier League. Mm-hmm. It's four in some of the lower leagues there, and up beneath the Premier League.
Yeah.
And it's just emotionally fraught for those to whom it happens.
But they accept it. The amazing thing is that everyone accepts it and just goes, yeah, we're relegated.
Yeah, we're relegated.
But you can dig your way out of it. So it's like if you were at the bottom of the Major League Baseball
You would go teams, to AAA.
You would go to AAA at the
right,
end of the season.
Exactly.
And AAA teams would rise up to become part of Major League Baseball for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
And one day on a train platform, I heard Charlton fans, that's a team pretty close to London, singing We'll Be Back. I actually got kind of teary.
Yeah.
I
think they're still not back. That was 2007
they're
or
still not. Wow.
Yeah. You can stay down there a long time, including Pompey has stayed down there a
long
time.
Do you still wear Pompey gear?
I wear my Pompey raincoat.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
Does the average Brit soccer fan, do they stick with one team in one league? Or how do they keep track of all of the leagues and all of the teams? I mean, is there like some big tote board someplace where they can figure out what's going on?
Oh, boy, do they stick with one team.
One team, okay.
Beyond even, you know how if you have a team here and it's out of a certain competition, you might choose, they don't choose another.
Okay. Right.
Not typically, you know. No second favorite teams, no team that's kind of like this out
even
here.
If they've been relegated and relegated, they hang
still
on.
Not.
Okay.
It's in the blood. It's in the blood.
That's great.
Yeah, this is passed down generation.
Dad, grandfather,
yeah.
It's
awesome.
And you're proud. No matter how much you get relegated, you're proud that you stick with it.
Yeah.
That's as much of it as anything else, sticking with your team.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I see that now and then, you know, but not in the same way. I don't see it in the same feeling of, there's more of an embarrassment here.
Yes.
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 And Chuck, if you took a Brit and dropped him into a particular American sports landscape where you felt he would be as at sea as you were at first in soccer, what American sport would that be?
I'd choose college football because it's so strange.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I mean, there's 7.4 billion people in the world or whatever, and we're, what, 320 million?
Something like that,
We're the only people who come close to sending 100,000 people to the stands for
a college game.
We think it's normal, but it is deeply eccentric human behavior.
Mm-hmm. But wonderful human behavior. There was a great story. We're talking to Chuck Culpepper, author of Bloody Confused, an American sports writer seeks solace in English soccer. One of the greatest vignettes in your story is talking about tailgating in the United States. And I think you said it's like heaven with beer, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's...
I think college sports in general, like, I realize the corruption, and that's part of what got you cynical about sports. But college sports is still really fun.
And the corruption is fun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I wish we were just honest about it.
Yeah.
I think it's like... The old SNL skit about the all-drug Olympics. Just take whatever you want. I don't care.
Just whatever you want.
Yeah,
just be honest about it. If you're over 18, go for it.
Yeah.
How long did it take you on this journey? So you go over there. How long did it take you to find the joy again? Because it seemed like reading the book and listening, but it seemed like for a while you were trying to be a fan, but you still, your mind kept going to, oh, I'm a sports writer. I'm covering this as a sports writer. How long did it take, or what was the defining moment you went, I'm a fan, and I can actually root for Pompey.
So on my relegation weekend, I chose three clubs that were near, they were on the brink of relegation. And that year, the relegation was tight among six of them, I think, five or six.
There's so many teams.
So I went to Portsmouth, and they had their gross stadium, you know, with just who knows what strains of what on the restroom walls, you know, things like that. You know, and they were in 16th. And if you finish 18th, you get relegated. Mm-hmm. And they had a full. It wouldn't be like that in the U.S. I didn't think. They had a full stadium.
Yeah, sure.
How many people?
Maybe. Oh, I've forgotten. 16,000. Yeah, something like that. And little children were, they beat Middlesbrough. We beat Middlesbrough. That's when we became we that day. Yeah. And they just, they chanted. I can remember little kids chanting, "We are staying up. We are staying up."
That's awesome.
Singing, "We are staying up." And they had, and I got big goosebumps.
Mm-hmm. You know,
and you started singing along with a lot of the cheers, a lot of the chants.
Eventually.
Yeah.
But that day I was just, wow, this is... You know, you can remember, late season baseball stadiums where somebody's hopeless mm-hmm. and you can just see the clumps of fans here and there.
Yeah.
You know, and Expos. Here they were. Yeah. It was full. Yeah.
You got to see Wayne Rooney in his glory days.
That's right.
Yeah.
Effing beauty, I believe, was an expression used more than once or twice.
The second game I ever went to.
Read my lips. Yeah.
Have you seen him since he's been here?
No.
He's
in person?
Playing. We've been to a couple games, and it's wild to watch him there because you watch the rest of DC United and whoever they may be playing. You go, oh, good high school soccer. Out of way to go. And he comes on, and it's like watching a cat with a bunch of mice, even at his advanced age of, 36?
Well, him and Acosta, right? Are the two that you just go, wow, he's really remarkable. Better than everybody else.
Last spring, I went on a tour of the neighborhood where he grew up. Mm-hmm. You know, he married his wife from down the street.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? You know, and when he debuted for Everton when he was about 16,
mm-hmm.
after the match where he scored, he came back and kicked it around, you know, with his buddies in the neighborhood. And
that's awesome.
So how did this wonderful experience, if it did it change you when you came back and become American sports writer again? Did it change how you look at sports now and how you cover them?
It's made everything still seem fresh.
That's good.
Refreshed.
That's very good. Come back in 6 months, that'll be gone, right?
I hope not.
March Madness is still incredible.
Yeah. Well, Chuck, I'm a former sports editor. I have to say, even when I read your game stories, there's a freshness to them.
They're
there's
so
a
different
difference
from everybody else's. Yeah. They're so different.
Without editorializing, but they are very unique in their perspective.
I can't handle compliments.
Too bad for
we
you.
Don't give many of them out, so don't worry. Yeah. My phantom daughter, so there are very few things she will stop and read. She stops to read The Athletic.
That's awesome.
And
as when she should.
And when I said we were having you on, she goes, oh, he's good.
Yeah. Like,
that is high praise. That is high praise indeed. So I think you're like you're a modern day de Tocqueville. You go out there, you look
How
at these
that?
Things. No, seriously, I just love when people go out and in various ways figure out something going on with human nature. What did you learn about human nature when you were doing this?
Well, after London, I didn't have a job, and I ended up 2 years in Abu Dhabi, you know. And that's Dubai is 70 miles away. It's like Washington, Baltimore, basically. Mm-hmm.
Dubai's just slightly different than Baltimore. I'm just slightly. Seabed.
Dubai is the Baltimore of that equation. But that's the crossroads of Earth now. When you go to I highly recommend the immigration line at the Dubai airport. It's incredible.
Wow.
Because?
Because all the workers from South Asia and Philippines and then Asians coming from that way, mm-hmm. Europeans coming from this way, and it's, you just look, I always look across the room and just think, some representation of most of humanity is here.
Is here at
this mm-hmm. And we're
place.
Not thinking about them.
Yeah.
Right.
What's next for you?
The Kentucky Derby.
Excellent. Awesome. Who's going to win?
I'm going to New Mexico first to see Mine That Bird, who won.
Oh, okay, sure.
10
Aww.
Years ago, the long shot. You know,
yeah. Tell him we said hi.
Still living in New Mexico. Yeah. Roswell sees UFOs.
Is he into the UFOs? Yeah, good. Yeah. Good. Excellent.
And but I haven't. I never have picked a winner ever, even once.
Almost no one else has either.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. Okay, so it's Chuck Culpepper. It is a fabulous, fabulous book. Again, I felt like I reading this and listening to it. I felt the way I felt about Jane Levy, who wrote the great book on Babe Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not into Babe Ruth or baseball, that book is worth reading.
Yeah.
This is worth reading because it's just a great look into human nature. It was wonderful and wonderfully uplifting. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for being here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stick around. We've got one more segment to do, which is going to be done in 7.5 minutes.
Yeah, somebody's on the
thanks
time.
Thanks for the cheese. Too.
Yeah.
Yorkshire.
It was great cheese from CW, which sponsors this segment. God bless CW. And we're going to come back with not the deserted island, but take the Bard to the Bahamas.
Right.
So come back. love the island music. Okay, we're back. Briefly.
I want a yellow bird.
Yeah. Yes,
they're warming up, so Tori's got to go.
Instead of a deserted island, and Chuck, we didn't prepare you for this, but we'll put you on the spot anyhow. In honor of Shakespeare's 455th birthday tomorrow, we are going to take him to the Bahamas. And so if you have to take one work of Shakespeare with you to the deserted island, mm-hmm. what will you take? I think Michael needs to go last.
I think so.
Because I think he's got a great after reading for us.
When he's done, we're all going to end the show.
Under 6 minutes, okay, buddy? Yeah. Under 6 minutes.
Yeah. Time
David, would you like to go first?
Sure.
You and I are going to be brief.
It's really brief.
Yeah, go.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I've read every work of Shakespeare because I haven't. I have seen Othello. I have seen King Lear. They're wonderful. The one line, I don't even know what you call it, a stanza of Shakespeare that I have memorized because I think is so beautiful and so remarkably poignant is a line from Romeo and Juliet, and she is talking about Romeo, and she says, this is before the end, she says, when he shall die, take him and cut him into little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all of the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
Lovely.
I'm going to cry.
I just think
that's
so beautiful.
Yeah. Ninth graders are swooning everywhere. Yeah.
That is fabulous.
Yeah, I love that. I love that line.
Jeannie?
To my surprise, I think I took two or three semesters of Shakespeare in college. One, because I liked the teacher, and two, because she gave me good marks, but
there you go.
To my surprise, I preferred the history plays to the tragedies and the comedies. Mm-hmm. And my favorite history play was the obvious Richard III, because he's such a quintessential villain.
Didn't mm-hmm. they find him recently under a parking lot outside London or something?
Cave Paradise.
Yeah.
Put up a parking lot
under a Wawa's
over Richard III. Yeah. He was killed in a battle, and there was some confusion about where he wound up. But he's so treacherous and so villainous and so Machiavellian. And he's a hunchback and he's deformed, and yet he manages to manipulate some of the most powerful people in the monarchy. And there's wonderful lines, my kingdom for a horse, and now is the winter of discontent. Those are sort of the obvious ones. Mm-hmm. But I just, for some reason, the history plays to me were what I like about novels that are sagas, because if you know mm-hmm. something about the Tudors or the Yorks or whatever, you can kind of figure out where Richard III is in those sagas. And so that is, it's not
I
an
like
obvious
that.
One.
And that goes counter to what we would have assumed for Jeannie. I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Mark?
I thought you were going to go next. Well, anybody that knows me knows I love ancient history, and Julius Caesar is mine. Mm-hmm. It was my first introduction to that time period, and then having studied it, you know, so much in college and then afterwards, Julius Caesar is one of the most fascinating characters in history, and that time period, what happened with the assassination and following that with Mark Antony and Brutus and everything, it's one of the most fascinating periods of history. Just in my view, so for him to have written about it and to bring it to light, you know, I think one of the reasons we still remember Julius Caesar is because of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I was reading in one of the productions of it, John Wilkes Booth was in a production of that.
Yes,
but did not play Brutus.
No.
Played Mark Antony, and I think if we're going to go back and recast that, I'm like, Johnny, you got to play Brutus because this is going to be you. So that, for to me, that's always been the one, and I still love it to this day.
I love that one, Chuck. Do you have one favorite Shakespeare? You can say no. You can just say this is a stupid segment. I don't want to.
King Lear is the closest to Southeastern Conference football, right?
Good.
Is that it?
Yeah, it's good.
It's an excellent answer.
Good analogy.
Yeah. I actually was going to go with King Lear, you know, crazy old man, mm-hmm. desperately mean, evil daughters. And I thought, no, that's too close to home. So I'm going with Macbeth. You cannot beat Macbeth. Greed, envy, murder, mm-hmm. ambition, doubts.
Fair is foul is fair.
The story just grips you, and you don't want to put it down. So I'll go with that. But Michael, bring us home, honey.
This is a really tough question for me. In terms of the histories...
Again, we have...
I'll be done when I'm done. In terms of the histories, I love those histories for modern interpretations. I love the comedies if I wanted to see it in person. If I'm going to study something, I want it to be something that is a bit new to me as we come back to novel. I would actually bring with me for this question Taming of the Shrew. It's one of the Shakespearean plays that my wife has not read. She loves 10 Things I Hate About You, so I would love to explore that play together. What's great
that
about Shakespeare
come back to haunt you.
Is returning to the language and unpacking it. Every single moment of exposure gives you a different interpretation of that line. If we think back to what's so great about Romeo and Juliet, it's frivolous, it's teenage love, but there is so much beauty in those lines. Side story, one of my worst teaching interviews ever happened when I was invited to interview at a high-powered all-girls school, and they happened to be in the middle of the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet. 26-year-old teacher trying to bring in some personal experience to that moment did not go so well. And in terms of teaching, Macbeth is so much fun as you have kids who are likely for the first time, because so many of these plays are age appropriate to where kids can understand them. So you get Much Ado About Nothing maybe later in high school. You're going to get Macbeth freshman, sophomore year. You're going to have Othello sophomore, junior year, King Lear junior year. But you're going to have something like Julius Caesar in middle school. Macbeth, when you're trying to understand the arc of this man as you go through those big soliloquy moments from if it were done when 'twere done, then 'twere well it were done quickly. If I can get away with it, sign me up to, is this a dagger I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. To, wow. I'm being led to this act, to our fears in Banquo stick deep. Again, stick deep. We have this play on the actual dagger that we know has done the deed, if it were done. And we end with the one that everyone knows. Think about just the visual quality of this. Out, out, brief candle, life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot. Imagine if that's what you think your life is. You are, before that we get, you're just a brief shadow. You're not even a fully texturized person. You are just the shadow of a man walking to your death.
Excellent.
Now for Tori.
On that happy note.
Well, let's go back to Othello for the Capitals tonight.
Yeah.
This is the night that either makes me or foredoes me quite.
Okay.
Ooh, that happens. It's only game six.
Ominous.
Be another one.
There's some perspective of his sports writer.
Okay, David gets the surprise award of the evening, though. That was fabulous, David.
What?
Well, we knew Michael could deliver. We were counting on Michael delivering.
Yes.
David, good job.
It's my favorite.
It was great. Chuck Culpepper, thank you for joining us. Come back.
Thanks for having
me. Come back from your world travels or whatever next wonderful thing you do. Come back and talk to us about it. We'd love to have you again. Everyone should go out and buy and read and listen to. I recommend listening to it because you get to hear you sing, which is really something.
I didn't know that.
Wow. How could you have forgotten? Next week, we come back next week for episode 23, and we are going to have four remarkable young women. I'm not sure where they're all going to sit and how many microphones we're going to have. But they have this wonderful book out called Yes, She Can, 10 Stories of Hope and Change from Young Female Staffers Who Worked in the White House. And it's really good and really interesting. And
cool.
We're really looking forward to having them. Go Caps! Thanks, everybody.